Our first speaker is Harry McMillan. Harry is the chief executive of MEND, Mind Exercise Nutrition Do It. It's an organization dedicated to reducing global childhood and family overweight and obesity. Mr. McMillan has 13 years experience in advising, managing, and building organizations. Harry, yes, sir.
Good morning. It's I like this. It's very, very nice way in America when you say good morning at conferences. People say good morning back to you. It's very polite. It doesn't happen in the UK. There's lots of things we've been learning, actually, in global perspectives that I think Clara and I can take back. So thank you very much. What I'm going to do is skate through this presentation fairly quickly and just give you a brief flavor of what MEND is and what we do, and also what we're starting to do here in the US. It's actually, in a way, the wrong way around, because Clara's presentation should probably have come first, because that's the policy presentation. So you're looking at the bottom up and then the top down afterwards, maybe. So briefly on our approach, talking about one of our programs and then what we're doing in the US. As you heard, MEND stands for Mind, Exercise, Nutrition, Do It. And we are a social enterprise that's been set up to enable a significant, measurable, and sustained reduction in overweight and obesity. And we partner across different sectors to achieve this. So across the private sector, public sector, third sector or charitable sector, and also with academia. And it's, we believe that a societal problem like obesity needs a societal response, which means trying to straddle the sometimes painful divide across those different sectors. Our philosophy or our approach is that everything we do is designed by specialists. That's obesity specialists or delivery channel specialists. And it obviously conforms to all the relevant guidance in whichever country it's operating in. But everything we do is designed to be scalable, replicable, measurable, and cost-effective from the outset, so before we start the research that we do. And then we do ongoing research and continuous improvement. It's for delivery by non-specialists who know their communities, and we train them and provide them with resources. And it's set in the community. It's not a medicalized model of the world. And we seem to have a formatting problem, which means that our self-referral participants fit in, but the ones who actually are referred don't get onto the slide, so sorry about that. We also think that it's very important to have a whole range of different programs and resources for different ages and stages. So looking at obese, overweight, and healthy weight, at primary prevention, secondary, tertiary prevention, and also training for frontline community staff. I won't go through these in detail, but we've got programs for different age groups and primary prevention resources for use in schools, different trainings for the programs, and also what we call sort of obesity 101 trainings for child obesity awareness and also how to talk to families about weight. So what do you actually do when you have to speak to a real family of children and parents and stuff about rather a tricky subject, and how do you address that in a way which doesn't cause harm and doesn't cause embarrassment? And then we're working on developing other programs for pregnant women and the first year or two of life, and also tentatively moving from the work we do with the parents to work for just adults without the children. We have a very strong research team and a track record of research, starting off with a feasibility trial and a first randomized controlled trial in the UK, also looking at the rollout data, so the data of the non-research sites. We started a second RCT in the UK and also are applying for funding for an RCT here in the US and also in Australia. And you can see the US research team from a combination of Baylor College of Medicine, University of Texas, School of Public Health, and Research Triangle International, who we're very pleased to have as our partners. Very briefly, and there's lots more of this if you are remotely interested, basically what it says is that across a range of different indicators, and these are some sample ones, waist circumference, BMI, recovery, heart rate, self-esteem, we looked at measurements at the beginning, that's the first column, the middle, the end of the program, which is the three-month column, and the end, so 3 months after the end of the program. And the blue is a control group, and the green is the intervention. And what you can see is that the intervention group improved in all those measures over the course of the program, which was a nice start. When you're involved in these things, as the data comes out, you think, phew. And then what was really interesting was that it actually got better 3 months after the program with no follow-up. And it became highly statistically significant on all those metrics and others too. And then those outcomes were sustained at 12 months, which was also encouraging. That was within group as opposed to controlled, because our control was a six-month delayed intervention. And then obviously the feedback that any intervention like this gets with translation. We just get reams of that. The reason that's important is because it gave us a very, people enjoy these programs, made us have a very high attendance ratio, a very high attendance rate, and a very high retention rate for the study overall. And moving from research into action, it's actually very hard work, and it's never finished. And that's the thing that can sometimes be a little bit depressing, but can also be very exciting. The fact it's never finished means there's always work to be done. But it means that you also, by including feedback from the people on the ground, the deliverers of the program, the parents, the children who go on it, you can get all sorts of things that you'd never have thought of yourselves, and we never have thought of at the beginning. So we provide kits, we provide manuals to make sure we're standardizing the delivery of the program and getting a base quality assurance. We provide resources for children and lots more than just the ones pictured there. And then there's a whole infrastructure behind it. So we've got a secure web-based system to capture data, to spread resources. We have a partnership development team to help develop partnerships on the ground across different sectors and different organizations, a network of trainers, and obviously a continuous improvement process. We work with both funding and delivery partners to actually deliver the programs, so we don't do it ourselves. We design programs, which we then help others to deliver, and we help form partnerships between funding and delivery partners. We provide the monitoring and evaluation. So in the UK, some of our major partners are highlighted on the right-hand side. You have some private sector organizations, including Sainsbury's, which is the second biggest supermarket in the UK. Just as a matter of scale, the second biggest supermarket in the UK is the same size as the biggest supermarket in Texas. So, you know, things are a little bit bigger over here. I know Texas is big, but this is, you know, it's a nice reality check for our perspective. Change for Life, you'll hear more about from Clara, and we work very closely with them. Fitness Industry Association, and across a range of different sectors. That's where people are running our programs in the UK, and you think, wow, that's great, that looks really nice, even though the UK is small compared to the US. But that only reaches 1% of our obese and overweight child population. So actually, we get cheered up for about 5 milliseconds, and then we think how much work we've got to do the rest of it. As a brief where we are, we've got a 20-year research partnership in the UK formalised with the leading children's hospital. We work with 65 primary care trusts. That's UK acronyms for you. They're part of the National Health Service, and 35 local authorities as lead organisers of our programmes, and lots more as subsidiaries. We've had 12,500 families go through our programmes to date, increasing at about 3,000 a term. We work in 5 countries, mainly the UK and Australia, and just starting here in the US. We've got out quite a lot more of our primary prevention material to schools. And that we co-branded with Change for Life, which is the Department of Health initiative. And we have raised about $35 million worth of funding from public and private sources to deliver these programs free of charge to people on the ground. Oh, arrows have gone wrong. The 7 to 13-year-old program is for obese and overweight children only. It's family-based. Parent or caregiver is required. And it's 10 weeks of intensive intervention, followed by family support for tapering off up to 2 years. And just some pictures to bring it to life. We play games on the behavior change side. Who wants to be a healthier, for example? Land-based exercise, water-based. We teach people to read labels and give them nutrition targets. Very practical demonstrations, bringing to life the amount of fat and sugar in different products, going on a supermarket tour, peer modeling, or weakest link, as you might call it. And we have a website for a sustainable outcomes program. In the USA, we've fully adapted it to the US context. That's quite difficult, not just the US context, but any internationalization. We've had practice in Denmark and Australia and New Zealand beforehand, so we thought we'd practice on smaller places before we got to somewhere as complicated as here. But it's from a policy and dietary perspective, language. We've now got our handouts in Spanish as well as in English. We set up a foundation, which we're in process of getting 501c3 registration for, and that's to deliver the program to low-income families in underserved areas. We've conducted some successful feasibility studies in New York, and have our first rollout and research pilots in Texas, starting in the fall, which we're very excited about. And we hope to start a multi-site RCT in Q3 next year with the organizations I mentioned. These are our current partners in the US, or some of them, and I'm under time pressure, so I'm skating through. I mentioned them beforehand, so thank you, all of you partners in the US. Our initial findings are that the results of the very first pilots are largely in line with the UK results, which is encouraging. The cost is between $350 and $750 per participant, and that compares quite favorably with some of the other alternatives. And there seems to be a good fit with what's going on at the moment in the obesity landscape. We're looking for advisors and board of trustees for our foundation, so if anyone's interested, feel free, or you know someone who is very helpful, then let me know, please. And we're also looking for funding partners, especially in the states where we have delivery partners. And our final thought, my closing thought, I won't leave you with, because I don't have time. So thank you very much, and we can come back to that at some later point.
Is this the right one?
Yeah.
Okay. Just take a seat.
Thank you. And really, really happy to be here. I will start quickly because I know I'll be at time pressure at the end. I am head of the cross-government obesity unit, which is in the UK. I'm based in the Department of Health. Actually, it's a joint program with our Department for Children, Schools and Families, so our education department. And I guess that's, in terms of policy, as you'll pick up as I go through, that's one of the things that I definitely want to get across, the need to do this work across government. A few years ago, in 2007, we had the Office of Government Science called Foresight put out a report which has been really important for me as a policymaker in building the case for why we need to act on obesity. Here are some of the their findings. I think we know about, or increasingly know about, the health impact, but they also modelled the impact both for healthcare costs, so not just on the individual, on the health service, and on society as a whole, and came up as Harry was saying, we need to get used to putting our numbers in US context. What is a big number in the UK of £50 billion per year as a cost by 2050. It also puts the forecast rates of obesity for men, women, boys and girls up to 2050. So that was a really important, it wasn't the UK government hadn't done nothing before then, but it was a really important independent study which looked at the impact going forwards up to 2050. They also came out with this system map, which I don't know if many of you have seen. I put this up not so that you can look at the, I think it's 132 individual factors, but really, again, as from a policy perspective, to say how important this has been in building a case for multifaceted approach, not just a single approach. So the orange bit in the middle is energy balance. Then the other factors, they've got biological factors underneath, food to one side, physical activity to the other. And then as you go out, it moves from the individual action or the individual decision point through to the wider cultural point. And again, psychology and culture at the top. So it kind of moves out and shows how there are various things that are very much individual decisions, but actually how we overestimate the power the individual has in this context. And that's been a very important bit of the context for me in England. So in 2007, came up with the targets that the government has committed to, that by 2020, we aim to reduce the proportion of overweight and obese children back to where they were in the year 2000. So that's currently on the rise. And our goal is to flatten that rise and then to bring it back to where it was in 2000. And we are now halfway through a three-year program called Healthy Weight, Healthy Lives, which had committed funding from the Treasury and was one of the goals that was put into our National Health Service, local prioritisation, and our local authorities the same. Again, this wasn't perfectly modelled, but just wanted to say that we use the best available evidence, and I think, again, that's a theme for anyone working in this area needs to get used to build the best case with the best possible evidence. It's got five themes, and I'll just run through them quickly. It's worth saying that for four of them are really about prevention. So our plan for Healthy Weight, Healthy Lives is focused on children, and it is very much focused on preventing. So early prevention of weight problems, children first of all, then on the energy inside, promoting healthier food choices. On the energy outside, how we build physical activity into our lives, and that's very much, just as an aside, we very much talk about physical activity into our daily lives rather than exercise or sport, because we believe the evidence shows that for the bulk of the for the majority of the population, we need to reach everyone. This is the best way of getting people moving more. Fourthly, looking at incentives, so how to encourage people to take decisions now that will have a health benefit later on, and looking particularly at the role of workplaces in that for adults. And finally, personalised advice and support. So our fifth theme, and that's for people who are already overweight or obese. So as I say, it's largely skewed to the prevention and to children, but obviously in terms of treatment and what our National Health Service offers and the cost of that, there's a very important piece there as well. I won't go through all of these, though my slides will be available afterwards. I'll just pick out a few. I suppose the point I wanted to make is that we have taken the foresight evidence and said that we need to do many things on many fronts. So we've got a program to weigh and measure all 4 and 11-year-olds in England. We've done work on early years on breastfeeding, a lot of work going back for a few years now on school food and on school physical activity. For food, again, we find, and this might be something that comes up in the questions, that we can make a bigger case for action where children are concerned and there are restrictions on the advertising of TV, food on TV. But lots of work with food manufacturers and retailers about making their products more healthy. On physical activity, we've done things that are around what the individual can do, so particularly walking and cycling and active travel, but also thinking about the built environment. And we've got a Healthy Towns program, which was a bid fund where we've matched money for what they are going to do locally. Incentives in the workplace, want to do much more as the public sector as an employer, which I have mentioned earlier today. We're in the same position where the Department of Health canteens vary, but they vary from quite bad to kind of medium bad. And some work with the private sector. And, of course, advice and care for those already overweight and obese, which is delivered through the National Health Service, and NICE is our organisation that sets the guidelines for how that clinical care should be given. So we've, as I say this, we're now kind of a year and a bit in, and we've said that we would report each year as a way of keeping ourselves true to what we said at the beginning, but also because we know that this is a large ambition and that we are going to need to build up each year and do more than we were doing the previous year. So this is divided into what we're doing on the individual, how we tackle this obesogenic environment, how we support people in need of weight management advice and strengthen the delivery system. And again, there are more things that we're doing in the coming year. Just a few, a couple of slides about Change for Life, which is a big social marketing campaign which is creating a new voice to talk to individuals and families to encourage families to eat well, move more, and live longer. And We launched it to the public. There was a big kind of research phase, but in terms of our advertising in January, and it's obviously at a very early stage, but in terms of getting people thinking about, you will notice it doesn't mention obesity at all. You'll notice that it's very positive. And there's, you know, there are lots of factors behind Change for Life that I don't have time to go into. But one of our goals is to have a positive campaign and a movement. And here are some of the government departments, but also the wider public sector, the private sector, the voluntary and not-for-profit sector that we're working with, which is now, I think, up to about 120. And these are examples of one here. So what we're trying to do is work with a whole range of partners so that the society-wide movement encourages people. Obviously, for all of us, as we live our lives and our families, we don't kind of drop the kids off at school and think that that's bit for government, and then go to the supermarket and then think about how we're going to walk and cycle. All of these things are how we live our lives. We need to try and bring them together, and that's what can be done at a local level. So that's one of the things that we are most excited about, and we'll see how that goes. We are extending Change for Life to an adult audience, and currently just looking at the research on that, and that will be launched in January 2010. So that's our strategy. I suppose, as all strategies, the proof is in the pudding. We're seeing some, we have a lag of about 18 months to see our obesity data, and we're pleased that the latest data, the NHS, the Independent Information Centre, says that there may be signs of levelling off. Can't take any credit in that ourselves, as this is, as I said about the lag, this is 2007 data, so it may be that the work that's been going on longer in schools has begun to do that. But that's where we've got to, and I've had my zero warning. There are some things that I'd be happy to pick up in the questions.
The right one?
Yes. This final? Mm. No, it's not. It should say final.
These are the only ones you gave me.
I have it on my stick.
You want to? We're going to make a quick file change. While we're doing that, I'll just give you a brief introduction. Our next speaker is Sonia Kellmeyer. Joined the WHO regional office in Europe in 2005, where she worked as a technical officer on transport, physical activity, and health and non-communicable diseases, and the environmental unit. She works closely with the food nutrition groups and supports the work related to the WHO European Charter on counteracting obesity, and this includes a number of related publications on physical activity. She is also responsible for an international collaborative project on the promotion of health-enhancing physical activity, that's HEPA, health-enhancing physical activity, and part of the joint UNECE-WHO Secretariat on Transport, Health, and European Environment.
Thanks for that. Just in time. Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here and thank the organizers for providing this opportunity to present to you an overview of what's going on in the European region and what activities we're undertaking within WHO Euro. And I was asked to put a focus on intersectoral perspective, so I'm going to focus a little bit on that. I'm going to give you a very brief introduction on the situation and how we see the role of different sectors. I'm going to, again, very briefly present the overall policy framework and then focus mainly on some examples of policies that are out there in the European region. And then at the end, I'm going to make a small bracket on the economic approach, which I believe is a very powerful argument and where we need to invest more and become stronger. Now, Just a very brief overview. You've heard this before, but just to keep in mind that obesity is not just an American problem. It's really a worldwide problem, and it's also becoming an epidemic in the European region, with prevalence from 30 to 80% in adults. One in five children is overweight, and they're really frighteningly increases in numbers in overweight children. And the trend is still going up in most countries. Of course, physical activity is one of the two main risk factors for this. And around one quarter of the European population doesn't reach the recommended levels of physical activity today, which has been estimated to lead to about 600,000 deaths in the European region per year. Now, why are other sectors important? I'm preaching to the converted here, but just indulge me for a second. I do believe that, of course, the health sector, the sports sector, and education and schools are key to the solution, and they're definitely part of the solution. But what we believe is a very important part to address is these kinds of situations, and the second one is actually outside my office in Rome. So what we really need to focus on and to work on more is to provide the environments to be physically active, because nowadays most of our urban environments are really built around the cars, and they're not very conducive to being physically active in everyday's lives. Even in situations where that's not really necessary, and even in settings where people are actually inclined to be physically active. So this is why we believe that it is really important to work in other sectors, and that we need partnerships with these sectors. And here the health sector has a crucial stewardship role to play. And I believe we can't just blame the transport sector for not doing enough, because it's not their job to do health promotion. So it is really our job, and we have to blame ourselves if we're not effective enough in that yet, to win them over with the right win-win arguments and to really identify the key synergies and to speak their language, speak about climate change, speak about air pollution, speak about road safety. Don't speak about health, because that's not their issue. WHO has worked a lot to develop the policy framework around this issue over the last 10 years. I'm not going through these in detail. Probably you come across most of these, most notably the Global Strategy on Diet, Physical Activity and Health. And all of these really also underline the importance of multidisciplinary action and the multi-stakeholder approach from national to regional to local level. I'm just going very briefly to speak about two selected policies in the European region, and you find copies of those in the back of the room because I don't have time to go into detail. The first one is the Charter on Counteracting Obesity, which was endorsed by the 53 European member states of WHO in 2006 at a ministerial conference that took place, which was a very big conference with about 500 participants, almost all countries present. And this was the first time that physical activity was on the plenary of a ministerial conference of WHO. And this charter fully recognizes the role of physical activity for, but also beyond, benefits of obesity. Because one point I also want to make is that, of course, it's very important that we link up with the obesity agenda. But at the same time, we also have to be careful not to reduce physical activity as a means for obesity prevention solely, because you all know that physical activity has a lot more positive health benefits and is much broader than just obesity prevention. And the European Charter actually fully recognizes this, and it speaks about healthy lifestyles being the norm, the healthy choice being the easy choice. And it also, as a paradigm shift, I would say, very clearly says that obesity is not just an individual responsibility. It is, to a certain extent, we all have our choices to make, but the society also has a responsibility to make the healthy choice, the easy choice. Again, intersectoral collaboration, very much underlined, and also a focus on the local authorities that have a major role to play, especially with regard to physical activity and active living, and promotion of cycling and walking, which is quite unusual probably to be mentioned in a health strategy, very prominently as one of the means to counteract obesity. The document that was specifically speaking about the physical activity part around this is this European Framework to Promote Physical Activity for Health. This document contributed... Oops. there we go. This contributed to emphasize the physical activity aspect of the conference. It calls for awareness and attention to physical activity, but it really also wants to inspire national action, and it lays out the main approaches to take, the which sectors can do what. It makes a point on surveillance, on evaluation, etc. So, but it wasn't officially negotiated, by the way. So this isn't yet an official WHO action plan. It's a framework document that should guide action in member states. Now, while the political interest in physical activity has been rising a lot over the last few years, especially also around the conference that I just mentioned, and more and more documents and policies are being developed in countries, it's often been difficult for people to have access to these different examples. So one thing WHO has been doing over the last few years is to provide online inventories where people can find these policy documents from other countries to not reinvent the wheel and try to learn from what others have been doing. And in Europe so far, we have about 130 national policy documents available from a bit more than half of the countries. Most are on the national level, some are subnational due to the political organization of certain countries. About half of the documents we have are from the health sector, about 20% from the sports sector. And as I said before, we take a very comprehensive view towards physical activity promotion, so we also do include transport-related policy documents and documents which show environmental approaches. And you can see that those are the environmental ones for the moment less frequent, and or maybe we're just not as good as finding them yet. But we have some available. And I'm actually going to show you some examples from transport and environment, because you know the health and sports policies pretty well. They're just the standard kind of health promotion policies, so I'm going to focus on the other two here for a moment. We also did carry out a content analysis of 27 of these national policy documents, and again, you can find copies of that in the back because I don't have time to go into the results here. And we plan to do an update of that pretty soon, but it's not yet done. So what are countries doing with regard to physical activity promotion through transport approaches? There are different types of approaches that countries can take. And one of them is to increase the road safety, specifically for cycling and walking. And this is one thing that, for example, in the UK's transport safety policy is a part of their activities. Another approach is, of course, the classic cycling promotion plan. Here I show the one from Germany. And as you can see, of course, the health sector is not the driver here. These are ministries of transport, building and housing that we have to work with to make sure that the health side of cycling promotion is coming into the building. I'm going to go a bit over. I'm sorry, but I'm going to speed up. Walking, so far no national policy reported, and I think that is due to the fact that walking is very much not taken into account in transport planning yet, because it's not seen as a mode of transport. It's just seen as something that people do, but it has nothing to do with transport. So I think this is another part to focus on. Some environmental approaches here, Sweden and most notably Norway. I could do a whole talk only about Norway, but they're really unique, and they have made their Building and Planning Act the backbone of efforts to increase physical activity. And if you want to know more about it, you can contact me. Legislative approaches are much rarer in physical activity than in nutrition, of course, but there are some areas that can be legislated that I've mentioned here. Now, just very briefly, another minute on the economic arguments. Why is it important? Well, it's a standard tool of transport planning, so it helps us to speak the language of money, and it helps us to speak the language of other sectors. The public health benefits are likely to be great, but if they're not taken into account, they're not counted. What you don't count doesn't exist, largely. And it's increasingly applied to cycling and walking, but not always in a very robust way. So we've carried out a project to develop guidance and a tool for quantification of the health benefits of cycling and walking, and specifically a tool for cycling. And the beauty of this tool is that all you need are the two input figures on the top, the number of trips per day, and the mean trip length of those trips. And everything else is calculated based on best evidence default values in the tool, and it gives you the discounted present value of just from reduced mortality due to regular commuter cycling. Again, you can find more information on that. The uptake of this has been pretty quick, and we're really pleased about that. For example, England has already included it into their national toolbox for transport assessments, their official toolbox, and it's already been applied in a number of communities. Now, this is a busy slide. I just want to make 2 points. You see that it has been applied by a number of countries already. Sweden has also adopted it for their official economic evaluation tool for transport infrastructure. And you can see that the numbers that you get here, for example, Austria with a population of 8.5 million has calculated the current savings from cycling in Austria, which is 5% of trips made. You can build a lot of cycling infrastructure for this kind of money. So the savings from the positive health effects of cycling are substantial, and it's important to take them into account. I'm going to skip over this, just saying that we also looked, developed models for calculating costs due to transport, and in there for the first time, I think, we also included the effects of transport systems on decreasing or on insufficient levels of cycling and walking. You can find more information of that on that back in the back of the room. So obesity is not just a U.S. problem. The intersectoral approaches are really key, and the health sector should really not do it alone. The policy framework exists. Many countries have developed policies, so examples exist, and I think that we need to work more on the economic argument. And at the end, I put that up before I knew that Bill Clinton was gonna be here. It's evaluation, stupid. Please, 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 everybody, evaluate what you're doing and publish your results, because we need to learn what works and what doesn't. Thank you very much.
She's out of breath. Our fourth and final speaker is Roland von Mecklen, and he is employed at the VU University in Amsterdam, where he's full professor of occupational and sports medicine. And in this capacity, he's vice head of the Department of Public and Occupational Health and the director of research of Research Center Body at Work, TMOVU-MC. I'm sure he'll tell you about that. If you look at his resume, you'll also see about 4,000 publications.
I don't think so, Tom. And the other thing is, it's not only on my end. Okay, anyway, good morning. Who of you have ever been to Amsterdam? Well, good for you. Those of you who have never been there, you don't know what you're missing. There's a few things to say here. One thing is cycling gonna save the world? I don't think so. Do we have an obesity problem in the Netherlands? Yes, we have. And will we be able to solve this problem? Well, I'm not sure. Well, this is Europe. That's the Netherlands. It's a tiny country. If you travel for about an hour to the east or an hour to the south from Amsterdam, you're either in Germany or in Belgium. There's about 17 million people sort of living stacked on top of each other. So it's a very congested place to be. One of the other interesting features is that anywhere there's a grid, it's all below sea level. So we have a history of trying to pump the water out and a fight against water. So we have a lot of windmills. There used to be a bit of manual labor there also, but it's all been replaced by machines. So that's probably the start of the problem to begin with. So what is the problem? Well, you all know this is the problem also in the Netherlands. Jim Salas recognizes this, and I think Mark Fenton yesterday referred to it also a little bit. This is the bicycle rack opposite Central Railway Station in Amsterdam. So that's what it looks like. If you step out, this is what you see. And you won't be surprised that every now and then I just simply, if I come back, I can't find my bicycle back. Because I forgot the number, because there's numbers on the floor where I put it. And it usually happens when I travel by public transport more than once a week, because then you start to become confused. Now, in a minute I'll show you that we still have an obesity problem. And one of the arguments that it's less in the Netherlands than in the remainder of Europe, and also actually in Denmark, which is in this sense quite similar, is that it's said that we often cycle and walk to work. Now, does it really help? Well, this is a chart of the Netherlands, and this is people that adhere to the CDC ACSM public health recommendation for physical activity. And if it's red, then it's below average, and if it's green, it's above average. And average in this case is 50%. So you see that between 2004-2007, about half of our population was sort of meeting public health recommendations for physical activity, and the other half was not. So at least next to an obesity problem, we also have a physical inactivity problem, I would reckon, despite the cycling. Now, this is overweight in the Netherlands, and it will start all over again once you've seen it. But you see it like in the United States getting worse. And if it's dark blue, it means that about 47-53% of the population is overweight. Overweight. What's it like with obesity? If it gets dark blue, it's the percent of the population that is obese. So, despite the fact that we cycle and walk a lot, we have this obesity problem. Now, is this a linear increase or is this an exponential increase? This is a mixed longitudinal study in a medium-sized country in the Netherlands, Doetinchem. These data were published earlier this year by Astrid Noyons, one of my PhD students. And basically, in that town, four cohorts were followed for 10 years. And in the course of time, over the course of time, both the body mass index, or the body mass index was calculated. And, well, I'm going to, as a former PE teacher, I'd better get up. Because the interesting thing is the following. Because the cohorts were roof-tiled over each other, we have cohorts of the same calendar age. This is the old cohort and this is the younger cohort. Old, young. So you see that apparently there is an aging effect. So if you're a younger generation, it's always at the same calendar age, more fat than the older generation. That's one thing. The other thing is that seemingly getting more fat is a fact of life. If you age, you get more overweight, because all these cohorts, all these generations got more fat. But the interesting finding is that the rate of increase is greater the younger the generation is, which is represented by the slope of these lines. So it's not, even in the Netherlands, we're not dealing with a linear phenomenon, but it's an exponential problem. And the same is true for females. You can find this back in Journal of Public Health Nutrition, of first author was Astrid Noyon. So the Netherlands is relatively protected by our physical activity, but not protected enough, and we have a problem, and it's exponential. We try to do a little bit of calculations on trends of overweight and obesity, and depending on what scenario you take, it's going to increase. Now, what is the cause and what is the solution? Well, obviously, it's an energy balance problem. I don't need to explain this to you. But I find this a very interesting slide. It's a railway station, and you see people are queuing, actually, to get on the escalator, and there's very wide steps. Now the question to ask whether we're dealing here with abnormal behavior in a normal environment, and if this is the case, you need one-to-one interventions. But if this is normal behavior in a completely abnormal environment, you need to change the environment. And so far, all I've heard also here at this meeting is that we're sort of geared towards trying to change the abnormal behavior of the individual. You tell people, stop behaving abnormal. But if that is done in a normal environment, that would be okay. But if this is done in an abnormal environment, it's not going to change behavior. So maybe, and by the end, I changed my presentation a little bit. I'm going to try to politicize the issue a little. So we either have a high-risk approach, which we have in the Netherlands also, and I'll say a few words on this, which basically is that you try to identify those at risk. You truncate the high-end risk of the population, and you have secondary tertiary prevention, and you have a one-to-one approach. The alternative would be, obviously, to try to shift the entire population to the left by doing primary or even primordial prevention. And then we speak about lifestyle change and environmental approaches. Now, what is the focus of the... And this is... I don't work for the Dutch government, so I can easily say this, but this is the formal Dutch obesity policy. It's geared towards, surprisingly enough, towards healthy eating and physical activity. Now, in order to do so, in terms of the overweight, we've had a covenant, meaning that it's based on a signed agreement between stakeholders, and it's about voluntary action, and everybody is in there. It's the food industry, the physical activity industry is not in there, but might be represented by the Dutch Olympic Committee, it's the ministry, it's the healthcare insurers, it's everyone involved. And as of April this year, it's also the employers and the employees that have signed a collective agreement, which means the parallel interest in primary prevention. So there's a big drive towards voluntary solution of the problem. Now, what are the general priorities in these covenants? Well, we should monitor the trends, because if we don't monitor the trends, we don't know what we're looking at. So at least that sounds, from a scientific perspective, sounds very logical to do, and I think we should do that. There's an emphasis on education on food choices in schools and trying to change the offering at schools. And there's also a quest for a stricter commercial code for children under the age of 12. So this is, if it comes to overweight, the general priorities. They have said we should have two target populations. One is youth, and it's about the introduction of healthy diets and more physical activity in primary schools. Now, interestingly enough, physical education was sort of banned from schools, also primary and secondary schools, for all sorts of financial reasons about 15 to 20 years ago. And now they want to put it back. But the point is that the educational system is not capable of getting sufficient numbers of PE teachers back into schools trained. They want to introduce sports and physical activity near to the schools. I'll say a few words about that. And it's about healthy choices in high school canteens, because there's a lot of junk food being sold in high school canteens. But there's a bit of a problem there, because that's being outsourced. And once a service is outsourced, how the heck can you change that policy? And the other thing is, we have 40 designated deprived neighborhoods, because by the end of the day, in my opinion, this is all about education and socioeconomic disparities. We have 40 neighborhoods which are deprived, and the idea is to reintroduce sports and game facilities in these deprived neighborhoods. If it comes to adults, there is the introduction of a logo to promote healthy food choices, which is this logo, and that's in the in stores, worksite physical activity. The official presentation of healthy products in supermarkets, and there is raising of parental awareness regarding responsibilities towards childhood overweight and obesity. In terms of treatment, there's a clinical guideline recently introduced that medical personnel should do measurements of body mass index and waist circumference in order to raise awareness. And there's a protocol on diagnosis, treatment, weight maintenance, and follow-up of overweight and obesity. I think the policy, I don't have time to go into detail, I find the policy too short-sighted. It's too much geared towards short-term treatment of people that are probably already too sick anyway. Now, a little bit of food for thought. The question is, with all these issues, are we really making an impact? And are we looking at the right thing? You can also ask whether all these voluntary behavioral change interventions make public health sense. Well, yes, of course they do. But I feel, and I'm getting more and more convinced, that we need more draconic action. I don't know if you fancy, let's see if you fancy a Dutch cake. Now, water is an important issue in the Netherlands. So every child learns at a very early age how to swim, and this is the way it's done. And I'm not kidding. It's with the hook, and you sort of chase the hook. There was an ad, and Pijnenburg is a famous cake. There was an ad that if you would buy a swimming pool ticket, you would get one swimming pool ticket for free if you would hand over three packages of this product. You can calculate, there's two sizes, 310 and 600 grams. Let's take the smaller size. If the child nags his mother to buy three of these cakes, and if he weighs 30 kilos, he needs to swim for about 14 hours to get rid of the cake. So, you know, what kind of self-responsibility and self-regulation are we speaking about? Is it about a nanny state that was brought up also? Obviously, I don't believe in a nanny state, but I also am convinced that if we keep it to self-regulation and self-responsibility, even in the Netherlands where we do a lot of cycling, the problem is going to get worse. So, is it about health promotion, or should it be about health protection, which is a completely different way of thinking? 1853, John Snow, Broad Street Pump. There was cholera in London, he just shut down the pump, and the problem was gone. And maybe we should be a little bit more pragmatic on this topic also, and try to introduce a new type of sort of John Snow thinking. And of course, I, as a researcher, and I publish a lot, I believe in research also, but by the end of the day, this is about logical thinking also in trying to solve this problem. But if we do so, the future looks bright, and we will all become as fit and healthy as these animals, as you will see in a minute. Thank you.
Good way to end it.
Do you guys know in Netherlands what's happened with vehicle miles traveled, vehicle ownership, single use zoning versus, in other words, are there other deeper cultural shifts that might be counterbalancing the bicycle use, which, as you know, stayed fairly high?
It all has got to do with the ease with which people can commute from one place to the other. And now the city of Amsterdam has got the highest parking rates in Europe.
Cost, yes.
So. And that drives the use of cars out of the city. We have done a study in which we have looked at differences between four neighborhoods depending on the ease with which people could park the car. The higher the parking pressure, the more physical activity in that neighborhood, and the lower the body mass index corrected for socioeconomic standards. So there is ways of dealing with this problem. But obviously, if I was a politician, I don't want to restrict parking. Because, you know, that's, yeah. But on the other hand, there's increasing pressure now on these matters. Yeah.
Does that fall in the category of the draconian kind of intervention?
I think so. Yeah. I also like the idea that was put up this morning saying, look, if you can buy an apple for a nickel, you pay $10 for a hamburger. That's it.
In Switzerland, we also see very clear association between the availability of a parking space at the workplace and the mode of transport to work. And especially if the parking place isn't made available for free, that has a very clear impact. It's a very simple measure that employers
but,
can take.
But let me point out one of the complex problems in that sense. I work in a big hospital, 7,000 people working there. There's a high demand on nursing staff because of aging population, chronic disease and whatever. They need to, it's too expensive for them given their salary to live in Amsterdam. So they can't easily commute to work. They have funny working hours, as you may realize, because it's a round the clock job. So how do you deal with this complex issue? So, I mean, it's sometimes easier said than done. So there's a number of complex issues to this. So you can't just simply say get rid of the car, but it's about the way the entire infrastructure is sort of organized. And it's also about normative thinking. We're now about to start experiments in which we will try to change normative thinking in big companies on these matters, under the assumption that if you change the normative thinking of middle management, the employees will change their behavior.
Did you have,
yeah. Yeah, I just wondered, have you thought of any draconian policies that may in fact be politically acceptable? Isn't that usually the problem?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the problem is that, I mean, I'm not a totalitarian person either, because that won't work. But I'm convinced that from a public health perspective, self-regulation and self-responsibility is not going to change it. So what the heck, what do you do? Then yeah. what you should do is just try by building codes and other ways to slowly and gradually change the way people literally can behave. And it's also in the mindset of people. Because in a way, we blame the transport sector and we blame the builders and the this and the that, but they have really never thought about it. And they were never trained to think about it.
We have some more responses.
I think there's also, I think the Benham's point about the totalitarian response is a good one in many ways, but I think it's also, as you mentioned, an issue of education. And what we see in the programs that we run, the people who come through our programs, it's not the same thing for everyone. It's not like you can just say, you know, hey, by the way, carrot sticks are good for you, or it's portion size, or it's all about the calories in, or it's about the calories out. All these things are false debates. It's about having a rounded education,
yeah,
around nutrition and around physical activity, and actually understanding the impact, and understanding it in a way where they actually get it, as opposed to intellectually saying, oh yeah, I can read a label packet, which in the UK, 17% of our population can, at the high end of the estimates, so that leaves quite a few others who don't have a clue what they're eating. And then if they actually understand how to read it, point one. Point two, they understand what that means and what it translates into. So the example yesterday about the soda with the 15 teaspoons of sugar, do you actually load that up to your kid's lunchbox? No, you probably don't, but you happily give them a can of soda. So it's making those things very real. And we find that there's no difficulty whatsoever in changing people's behavior once they've gone through an education process. But it's not a simple education process that's just as simple as putting these things up and making them available. It has to be something that they're forced to be, it has to be ingrained in them. So the behavior change part of it is very important, because these habits are long established. Doesn't mean you have to lock them in a room and, you know, put them in front of flashing lights until they sort of agree and give up. But it is a process that is more than just putting up a few posters here and there and telling people what is in their food. But I think you can have a combination of the two, and sometimes it's very boring because it takes a while. But you can still educate people, and if you start in schools, you stop that happening going forwards, but you've still got a large lot of people in the middle who are really overweight and obese, who've already left school or been through a lot of it, who need that extra remedial catch-up education, which isn't actually that expensive and isn't that difficult to provide.
Second one?
The further we get away from preparing our own food to eat it in the home, the less we know about the food we're eating. And has there been studies about the trend of eating less at home versus the obesity and the overweight? Have you comment on that?
Well, we haven't personally studied it with our group, but we know that there's associations between eating out and obesity rates. So yeah, sure, skipping breakfast is another one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm gonna do a general question to the panel. That's sort of the blend of questions they gave me. And it's, how do you scale up your kind of program?
Yeah,
and how do you make sure these intergovernment, intersectoral processes work? Start with you guys, but then open it to the panel.
As I said, first you have to put quite a lot of hard work in. ideally you design it, if you're going to do a research program, you design it before the research in a way that it can be scaled up, should the research be successful, rather than taking a research project that's worked and then trying to change it to figure out how to scale it up. And it gets back to that working across sectors. So we're sectoral magpies. We take what works in different sectors and blend it. So we take continuous improvement from the automotive sector and apply it to what is effectively a primary healthcare intervention, along with the research from academia and various other things. And then you try and find the right, and it varies very much, it's very different in different countries, you try and find the right combination or sets of combinations of organizations, be they public sector or private sector, or charities that can work together to best deliver this on the ground. And you help them come together. And then you have to catalyze it. And finally, you have to make it as simple as possible so that lots of different people from lots of different places and different backgrounds can deliver whatever it is you're trying to do. So we have kits, we have computer systems, we have resources available online, etc., etc., etc. And you've got to figure out a way to disseminate this as the continuous improvement process happens. If anyone's got any specific examples, very happy to talk about it, and we're very happy to share what we have, if that can help.
And I'll ask Claire, how do you make them get along in these different settings?
Well, I think on the scaling up front, if we go back to that spaghetti diagram I showed from obesity, that is one way we can scale up, because as I think, you know, we're bound to have strategies that are on healthy eating and on physical activity. We should, they are good in and of themselves. The energy balance is the core to how we fix this problem. But the number of agencies and people who need to play their part is huge. It's vast, and it's not all within government's control. I think another slide was, you know, government shouldn't do this alone, can't and shouldn't. One of the things that we've done is try and build those alliances across government, and we've done that at a political level. Sometimes politicians can lead as well as follow, and sometimes I think in terms of the if what they realised that their departments had to do, sometimes they were bolder than some of the officials that we were talking to. And sometimes that's the case and sometimes it isn't. I think that the other thing, the other parallel is obviously other cross-cutting things such as climate change. I think we can learn a lot from how that agenda began to, or still in process, began to link up lots of different bits, not just of government, but of business, individuals, what they needed to do, and built the case slightly differently according to who they were talking to. And that's what we've got to continue to do inside government and outside to scale up and to begin to tackle this.
I'll ask, so you can answer that, but also want to know, who's done the best in Europe? So answer which one you want.
I'm just going to follow up on that first, but then say something on the other. Intersectoral work is very challenging. Let's not kid ourselves, it's not easy to do. So it's a big word that everybody uses, but it's very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. As you probably know from your experience as well, and there is no one fits all solution. So you really have to find to look at your settings and try to find ways to make it work. But probably often you need a champion. You need one high level person that believes in it and that can carry it forward. So that is probably important to try and find this person that can help you do it. And as I said before, we need to find win-win arguments for the others. We can't force them to work with us. They have to believe in it, and they have to see that they gain something from it. Otherwise, they're not going to help us. Why should they? So that is really the two things that spring to my mind first. Who is doing best? Huh? Cora? Canada is certainly a good case, but very complex and difficult, and Cora right there in the back of the room could tell you a lot more about that. In Europe, Finland is another good case. I guess the one of the main messages we can learn from that, again, not a message that politicians like to hear, it takes time. It takes a long-term investment to get things changing. And that's something we need to work as well to make sure that what is done has a long-term perspective and is not a one-off approach. And governments need to be behind this for more than just one election term.
I think that's a good way to close it. Everybody, thank you.